Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we kick off our new exhibit and content initiative, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, with four writers of speculative fiction, N.K. Jemisin, Matthew J. Kirby, Nnedi Okafor, and Nhi Vo, moderated by Michi Trotta. This conversation originally took place April 22, 2025, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center in Chicago. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good evening and welcome to Chicago Public Library. My name is Jennifer Lezek. I'm the coordinator of special projects in the Adult Services Department here. And on behalf of everyone at CPL, welcome, and we're so glad you're here. Tonight, we are thrilled to welcome back one of our favorite Chicago institutions, the American Writers Museum. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Carrie Cranston, president of the American Writers Museum. Please join me in welcoming Carrie to the stage.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing tonight? Good? All right. Tonight, we are kicking off and announcing a major new initiative for the American Writers Museum. American Prophets is an 18-month exploration of the intersections between writers, religion, and American culture. America's rich history of many religions is cataloged by our greatest writers and artists, and their work illuminates and changes the way we understand and practice those systems of worship. From the created gods of science fiction and fantasy in speculative works to satirizations of rituals by our greatest comedians, writing about religion connects us to one another across boundaries. American Prophets explores that in programming that begins tonight and continues through the opening of our museum exhibit in November. And so we're really excited about this program, about the series of programs and this exhibit, and we hope that you will come to more of these programs and that you will visit us at the museum when it opens, or this summer while the gaming and writing exhibit is still up. So I want to point out that this entire initiative is supported by a grant from the Lilly Endowment through its Religion and Cultural Institutions Initiative, as well as the Wayfarer Foundation and our trustees. We are very lucky to have partners like the Chicago Public Library who work with us on events like this, and we have partnerships across the city, and we're really looking forward to making this something that is going to touch all areas of the city and really excite people. So we begin American Prophets tonight with a conversation about how writers of other worlds create gods, new systems of belief, and work within those in the universe they create. And here to introduce that panel is our moderator for this evening, Michi Trotta. She's a 5-time Hugo Award-winning Filipino-American writer, editor, and narrative expert. Her work explores how to use empowerment, representation, and storytelling to attain collective liberation and to dismantle oppressive institutions, not just survive in them. She is the executive editor at the environmental justice and advocacy nonprofit Green America, and her work includes the Wing Luke Museum 2018-19 exhibit, Worlds Beyond Here, Expanding the Universe of APA Science Fiction. So please help me in welcoming Michi Trotta.
Wow, full house. Okay, I am so honored and thrilled to be able to introduce our speakers for the evening. We'll start first with N.K. Jemisin, who is a fantasy author and 2020 MacArthur Fellow, whose fiction has been recognized with multiple Hugo, Nebula, and Locus Awards. Most of her works have been optioned for television and film, and collectively, her novels, including the Broken Earth trilogy, have sold over 2 million copies. Her speculative works range widely in theme, though with repeated motifs: resistance and oppression, loneliness and belonging, and wouldn't it be cool if this one ridiculous thing happened? Nnedi Okorafor is the author of multiple award-winning and New York Times bestsellers, including Death of the Author, The Binti Trilogy, Who Fears Death, and Lagoon, currently in development at Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment. She has won every major prize in speculative fiction, including the World Fantasy, Nebula, and Eisner Awards, multiple Hugo Awards, and the Wallace Soyinka Prize for Literature from Africa. Nivo is the author of the novels Siren Queen and The Chosen and the Beautiful, as well as the acclaimed novellas of the Singing Hill Cycle. The series entries have been finalists for the Nebula Award, the Locus Award, and the Lambda Literary Award, and have won the Crawford Award, the Ignite Award, and the Hugo Award. And last but not least, we have Matthew J. Kirby, who is the critically acclaimed and award-winning author of numerous books for young readers, including The Clockwork Three, Icefall, The Lost Kingdom, The Dark Gravity Sequence, and the Assassin's Creed series, Last Descendants, A Taste for Monsters, and Star Splitter. He's also written adult titles for Assassin's Creed and Diablo video game franchises. Okay, thanks for joining us, everybody. This is great to see all of you here. See, we've got a really great crowd here tonight as well. So I'd like to start off with the basics of world building as our intro topic. So when you are establishing the shape of the worlds for your stories, where does creating systems of faith fit into your creative process? How do you start in building a fictional religion? And whoever wants to go first, unless you want me to pick on somebody.
I'm going to make you pick.
I walked right into that one.
You're the moderator. You're supposed to do the work here. Come on.
All right. Well, then I'm going to throw it right back to you, Nora.
I'm sick. Have some compassion.
Be nice to her. She's so sick.
I apologize in advance. I had bronchitis, and I am okay-ish, but my voice is not what it should be. I can only speak to my own process and my own books that I've written. I don't know what other folks, and I'm curious to hear other folks' process. For me, it depends on whether I'm writing a setting that is religious or a setting in which religion is just part of the culture. So I guess theocratic versus, a setting where religion is sort of the core of the society versus just part of it. So, for example, with my first two books that I actually wrote versus they weren't actually published first, the Dreamblood books, The Killing Moon and The Shadowed Sun, were set in an ancient Egypt-like setting in which religion was kind of the core of everything that they did. So I sat down and I designed the religion first. And the religion in their particular case was based on their cosmogony. When they looked up at the sky, that world was set on the moon of a gas giant. So when they looked up, they saw this giant thing in the sky with four bands of color around across it. And that became the source of a lot of their creation myths, their magic system, everything. They drew from the environment. But in other books that I've written where religion was just sort of part of what was happening, or in some cases religion represented an antagonistic relationship with nature and the divine, with the Broken Earth books, for example, where people believed that the earth was out to get them, then I built that religion kind of as I needed to illustrate that people hated God. And why, in this case, Earth. They viewed that as their God. So that's an example.
Nee, what about you?
So for me, when it comes to religion, it starts with need, and then it starts with death. So I start with religion as the weather. What are people reacting to? The kind of God that you need when you live on a floodplain is a lot different from the kind of God you need when you're living in a desert or when you're on a grassland, right? So, I come from Illinois, which right on the banks of the Illinois River. And the Illinois River was carved out in the span of 4 days by the Kankakee flood. That's pretty big, and that's how you have to think about a God is big. It needs to be that big. It needs to be that scary. And then at the other end of that, you have death. So one thing we can't control, one place where we can't take care of the people that we love, is after they go on. So when it comes to religion, how do we want our dead people taken care of?
I think for Nettie and Matthew, I'm particularly interested because the two of you write also write for young adult and younger readers, not just adult readers. If there is a way that you might approach the creation of religion in a fictional setting differently if you are not writing for adults. Nettie, could we start with you?
Yeah, I mean, well, first, when I'm writing about, I wouldn't even call it religion, I'd call it more spirituality. I'm not making a lot of what I write about up. And I'm really, for me, it started, okay, so I'm thinking of your question and then the first question. You're probably gonna have to remind me of the second one. But so the way that I started even writing speculative fiction was from encountering specifically Nigerian spiritual and cosmological practices. You know, I'd encountered that when I would visit with my family, I would hear about things and just kind of absorb all of that. And then also the idea of that some of these things were forbidden and are not supposed to be discussed. And then as I got older, I started understanding that this was colonialism happening, that a lot of people were viewing their own indigenous spiritualities as evil or terrible or wrong because of colonialism. So I understood that. And so when I started writing stories, I wanted to bring those forth. I wanted to honor those spiritualities and cosmologies, specifically Nigerian. And so that's what I was writing. I was kind of pulling those things forth. And I guess I'm putting them in a fantastical set, a fantasy setting. I don't know, like we're talking about categorization and those things. I just don't even like all of that. But yeah, so it's not that I'm not creating. A lot of the things that I'm writing about, I'm not creating them. I'm writing about spiritualities and cosmologies that actually exist, and I'm putting them in. And the reason I'm writing about them is because I want to see them honored. I want to see them flourishing. I'm kind of talking back to this idea of colonialism. So that's where I'm coming from. What was the second question?
The second part was, you know, because you and Matthew both also write for younger audiences. If there's a way that you approach the ways that you write about religion or that you create faith systems in fictional settings, if you do that a little differently for younger readers than adult readers?
I don't think that I do. I don't think there's any difference. Like if I'm, you know, as I just said, I don't see that I'm creating these things, but when I'm writing about them, I'm not, there's nothing, if we're talking about children's books, we'll put that on that side, but if we're talking about young adult, middle grade, and adult, I'm writing about it in the same way. I may feel, for middle grade, I may feel a need to explain things a little more, like contextualize things a little bit more, but that's really the only difference.
What about you, Matthew?
Yeah, I would agree with that. If anything, I'm trying to pack it with as much complexity and nuance as I can, even especially for young readers. And the way I approach it when it comes to various spiritual traditions that have shown up in my books, whether invented or not, religion operates at such a deep level culturally that I think of it in terms of like what are the beliefs that are not questioned. They're considered self-evident, and in my stories those are often being questioned, which I guess I hope young readers would take and perhaps apply to their own beliefs and biases that they might, I mean, not that they need to be discarded, but I think it's always good to reflect on those things that we don't reflect on. But I don't know that I would approach it any differently for children than I would adults, really.
Okay, yeah, because I was wondering if there was a different, maybe not approach it differently, but if there are different things that you think about first and foremost that you would be talking about or want to emphasize, which I think you just, which both of you clarified very well. And I think this actually leads quite well into our next question. I am sure you have all probably seen, there is a meme that uses an iceberg to illustrate what we tend to think culture is about versus what actually encapsulates culture. we're at the tip of the iceberg is actually a small part of what we see versus the vastness of the actual iceberg below the surface. On the tip of the iceberg, we normally have things like decorative details, like clothing or food or customs, versus the structural details that we don't necessarily see but absolutely underpin the world that we live in, like systems of government, economies, and concepts of family. So when you are writing about spirituality, when you are creating a religion, how do you approach creating the decorative details versus the structural details? And I will toss this one over to Nee first.
As someone who really, really loves aesthetics, I will say that when I'm working in a purely fantasy setting, a lot of times I'm starting with the aesthetics, but the aesthetics needs a reason to be there. If you don't, just from a pure craft standpoint, you are going to get a very empty and hollow experience if you just have a bunch of pretty flags or a bunch of altars. You have to take that back. If you want the pretty ornaments, you have to work backwards to how they got there. Like, and once again, this is a great place to start taking apart things like colonialism, imperialism. Why do we do that? Why does it look like that? Who gets to have it and who doesn't? And when you start unraveling it, when you start to pull it back and figure out, for example, why do you need an order of storytelling monks who are trying to keep things true? Why do you have those? And you start wondering, oh, for a long time ago, there was a huge need for them, and there's a reason they've been kicked off the continent. So when you start unraveling, when you start going back from the aesthetics, which I think are a fine place to start, you're going to find some interesting truths when you start asking why, who can have what.
Nora, what about you?
I like to start with the common stories that I know the people in that culture all know. I am not super religious, but I was raised Christian. You know, typical black church, went to Sunday school, vacation Bible school, miserable in vacation Bible school because it was summertime and I wanted to be somewhere else. And grandma was like, no, you can learn about Jesus. You need Jesus, baby. She was trying to tell me something. But so, you know, I grew up with the basic stories that are so common to Christian culture that I started to notice the ways in which we just kind of casually referred to those stories in our language and in our just everyday actions. And, you know, I find myself sometimes stepping outside or trying to step outside of my culture and looking at it as I think that an observer from another culture would, to the degree that I can. But, you know, you have to have that ability to step back if you are an artist, if you are trying to observe and understand people. You need to think about, you know, where does that phrase come from? You know, my grandmother would periodically declare, Lord willing and the creek don't rise. What creek? Where is this creek rising? Why is she referring to this? And why do I know what it means? So, you know, things like that are those are the things that make a religion part of a culture, and those are the things that when you are trying to create a culture, you need to insert in order to show the depth to which that religion is inculcated within that culture. So I start often by writing a few little stories that I think everyone in that faith will know. Like with the Broken Earth books, it was all about how Father Earth was pissed off because he lost his child and then did many bad things. And so everyone refers to, you know, Father Earth being angry and da, 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 da. They all know, they all have that same common language. Even their swears are built around that, those common stories. So I often start with those.
Nettie, so you were talking about how you are working with spiritual traditions that aren't necessarily fictional. So I'm wondering for you if there were any particular things that you noticed as you were working these systems into your writing that you were surprised by to find out, like, I thought this was just a detail, but this is actually part of a larger structural thing that is really interesting to delve into.
Wow. That's the kind of question where I would, like, have to sit and think about that for a little bit. I mean, it's always surprising. You know, it's I'm trying to think of one, and what keeps popping up in my head are masquerades. Masquerades is, because I'm always writing about masquerades. So masquerades are easiest way to, they're not easy to describe. They're not easy to describe. I keep hitting this wall. They are almost every, I think I would venture to say every Black tradition has masquerades. I mean, just worldwide. And so masquerades are like manifestations of the spirits and the ancestors, right? So that's one layer of it. It's theater. Another layer of it is theater. It's theatrics. There are costumes involved. There is possession involved. You become the spirit or the ancestor when you put this costume on. And there are many different types of masquerades, many, many, many different types. And they're very specific. They can be specific to place. They can be specific to village. They can be there are different masquerades who behave in specific ways. They could be very angry. They could be very comical. They can be small. They could be massive. They could be monstrous. They could be majestic. So there are many different types of masquerades. And so I've always been obsessed with masquerades, because growing up, whenever we would visit Nigeria, when we go to our parents' villages in Imo State, the masquerades would be out, and they would target my siblings and me. You know, I have run from the spirits. I've literally run from the spirits, and so that was the beginning of my obsession with them, my interest in them, because I'm like, what are these? They look in many different types of ways. So the Igbo ones, some of them look like giant bales of hay with cloth and colorful cloth figures on them. They shake and they dance. They can be really tall, and they can be terrifying. So my obsession with them started with the fact that I was chased by them as a kid. And then seeing all the different types, and then when you asked about them, there would be a lot of mystery around them. The first thing that I would be told is I'm not supposed to ask about masquerades, that I'm a woman. Women are not supposed to go near masquerades, which made me even more curious, so there's that. And then there are secret societies for those who can even put on the costume. And so there's so much to know about them. And I've always been obsessed about them. So they're always surprising me. The more I learn about them, the more I'm surprised, because there are different types. And there was one in one of the Akata witch books, Akata woman, there's a fire masquerade. And that was the one that I learned about as I was writing the book. It wasn't even that I was studying it. It was just a friend of mine who told me about it. And then I saw it, and I'm like, oh my God, that thing is terrifying. And so once I learned the what it was about, how it was, like the fact that there's mystery and how it's able to catch fire, and how does the person not burn underneath, like, so yeah, just an easy answer to your question, yes. I'm surprised all the time.
I mean, this was a major learning moment for me, so I absolutely enjoyed that. Thank you so much. Actually, Matthew, that brings to mind question, like, is there anything that you take particular joy in writing into your stories when you're coming up with faith systems? Are there things that you enjoy writing about that would be surprising or you hope entertaining, like, in a unexpected way for your readers?
Well, kind of to touch back on what Nora said, like I heard a definition, I can't remember who said it, of tradition, where tradition is often a solution for a problem that doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I often, when I'm making this stuff up for myself, I kind of take a little bit of delight in creating something that may not actually make sense to the reader, but internally it makes sense to me because I've traced that tradition back to perhaps the problem that gave rise to it in the first place. But by the time it hits the book, many of the people who use that colloquialism or people who continue that tradition, they may not understand where it comes from themselves as characters. So I do enjoy that, because I mean I'm also a school psychologist, and So the psychologist in me kind of enjoys that kind of thing too.
It's like you're setting Easter eggs for yourself in your own books.
They're entirely for me.
Do you ever share them with your? Do you ever like explain what the lost tradition was?
If it's relevant to the story, like it might come up in the story. Like if a young character is questioning something, then it might come up.
Otherwise, you just leave people hanging. Wow. Okay.
It's just like real life.
Bold choice there.
I don't do it all the time, but it's, you know.
You're just going to have a bunch of readers coming up to you being like, so what is the Easter egg in this book?
Right, yeah.
Well, actually, I would like to circle back to something that Nettie touched upon a little bit. And I know that there was a really great interview that Nora did back in 2012. So we are going way back in time here. With Book Smugglers, where she was talking about the problem of exoticism in fiction. This is a really great quote. I love this. Calling something exotic emphasizes its distance from the reader. We don't refer to things as exotic if we think of them as ordinary. We call something exotic if it's so different that we see no way to emulate it or understand how it came to be. We call someone exotic if we aren't especially interested in viewing them as people, just as objects representing their culture. And what I'm curious to know your... yes, that was you. I did my research, Nora.
I believe you.
I'm very curious to know, particularly, Nettie, as you're talking about, a lot of this is exploration for you of your own traditions, some of your own history. How do you navigate that exploration and inclusion of those details in your story with the complications of the external gaze that can be exoticizing when you are writing these details?
I don't really worry about that. I don't worry about it because it's I don't know, there's and I'm fully aware of it, but I kind of embrace it. For example, masquerades. Someone over there, they're normal. They're common. They're nothing to stop at. You know, for me, it's my Nigerian American gaze. It's the fact that I am born of Nigerian immigrant parents, and I'm born and raised in the United States with all of my experiences in this country, and then brought back over there. And those connections are made, but the connections are different. And so things that stick out to me are going to be different than things that stick out to people over there. And that's there's no problem with that. And part of it is also that part of the reason why I don't really worry about it is that what I'm writing about, I understand that I am not separate from it. I am deeply connected to it. Anything that, the way that it is viewed, whatever I create, is going to, it's going to fall back on me. The judgment will always fall back on me. So I have to take responsibility for that as well. So it's not just I'm writing about others over here and I'm exoticizing others over here and none of that's going to fall back on me. Everything that I'm doing is going to affect those who I'm portraying and myself because we're directly connected. So I'm not really worried about that. And I also understand that I understand my point of view very clearly. I understand that it is Nigerian American and there's nothing wrong with that and it's going to see things differently. I understand that. And so I think that's why I don't really worry about it. I don't have an insecurity about, oh, I might be looking at this in a skewed way. I feel like I come at it with an understanding and an awareness, and that is reflected in what I, you know, what I write, what I create.
Nee, when you wrote The Chosen and The Beautiful, which is a retelling of The Great Gatsby, highly encourage everybody to read it. One of your characters, the main character, you reimagine as someone who is Asian American. And there is, you know, a long history with our particular identities being, you know, not more than anyone else, but it is something that from direct experience I know is you are not only navigating the external pressures, there are things that when you write, you find you have exoticized yourself, particularly when it comes to looking at maybe spiritual traditions that you were not raised in, but maybe you wanted to reconnect with as part of your writing. So I'm wondering if that's something that you have navigated as a writer in your own storytelling.
So the first time I was ever called exotic was when I was about, I think I was about 7, and it was outside a fried dough stand by a nun. So, you know, I'm pretty comfortable with that particular identity. When you have to add hyphen American to the end of your labeling, you get really used to the idea of being considered other. That becomes a territory and a navigation that becomes a part of you. You're not just necessarily othered from one culture, you're othered from 2 or 3 or 4, depending on how many communities you end up in. And the best thing that you can do when you're trying to navigate them is not to hurt anyone, but at the same time to realize that you can't treat your readers as children. That's a thing I run into a lot when it comes to editing. It's they're like, well, do you want to explain this? Do you want to explain that? I'm like, no, the readers are smart. They'll figure it out. Like, a while back, I was reading When the Angels Left the Old Country, which was fantastic. It's full of labor history. It's full of Jewish history from the early part of the 20th century. It's great. And I considered it a privilege to read it with Wikipedia open because I didn't know any of that stuff. And I'm like, if they want the book, they can read it with Wiki open if that's important. And for me, that's part of the writing process as well. It's, you know, I ask around, I do my research. I understand that at some point I will get it wrong, and if I do, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's not going to stop me from trying again.
And Nora, I feel like you have things to say, because I've seen you nodding and shaking your head, and...
Just, I'm enjoying the fact that everybody else in the panel has really interesting things to say about this. I think of the Own Voices movement had its flaws, but the core of it was recognizing that when people are writing about themselves and their culture, however distanced that is from mainstream American culture, they are helping humanize, they are de-exoticizing those cultures because they're emphasizing the humanity and the peoplehood, personhood of everything that they're sharing. And I think that is one of the reasons why we're seeing such a big push on book bans right now, because the conservatives have realized, I don't want to start a whole to-do, but the conservatives have realized that their kids have been reading about people that aren't Trumpers, and that their kids are learning and understanding that those people are people too, and we can't have that. So, you know, I mean, it is the nature of what we all do that we are treading, you know, in waters sometimes that are outside of our own experience, but we're bringing those waters, well, that's a mangling that metaphor. We are sharing those waters, the waters with the desert of American culture.
Just lean into the metaphor, Nora. Just lean into it.
I had to do something. That was going somewhere really bad. Okay.
Well, you did well.
Okay. It's the cold medicine. I'm sorry.
Actually, Matthew, I am wondering from a craft perspective, I think it might be interesting for other aspiring writers to know when you were starting out, what were some of the things that you learned to be aware of in creating characters, creating cultures and such in ways that are not exoticizing? Were there things that you found you didn't expect you had to unlearn? Because I think learning from our mistakes is just as valuable as getting it right, if not more so on the first time around. So I would love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, something that I've always wanted to do in my writing is depict the world that I see. And so that includes diversity. Like, I want my world to reflect. I mean, I grew up with a dad in the military. I moved around a lot. I lived in a lot of different cultures. We were just talking about the Filipino food I enjoyed when I lived in Hawaii as a kid. So when I'm approaching that, though, like, I do feel a lot of responsibility to get it right. And there's that saying, don't be a tourist. Like, if you're going to go somewhere, then really go there. And then also listen. A friend of mine who may be in the audience tonight, Urania, she when I was writing an Assassin's Creed book that featured some black characters in New York City during the draft riots. She was gracious enough to read it for me, and she caught some glaring mistakes that I made that as soon as I saw it, as soon as she pointed it out, I was like, oh, I almost swore just there. Like, how could I have missed that? Like, I felt so dumb, but I was so grateful for her helping me to see that and then kind of fixing that so I didn't say something I certainly didn't intend to say. Like, it was never my intent to say that. So yeah, and I think that we all have blind spots and biases, kind of going back to what I said earlier. Like, again, to put on my psychologist hat, like, I'm kind of constantly trying to check my own biases and to make sure that I'm not going and leaving things unquestioned that should be.
All right, and I think this is actually a great lead-in to, this was a question that I was personally very interested in hearing your all thoughts on, because speculative fiction it is a very, very powerful medium. I think we've seen that in particular over the past decade, as it has become a genre that makes an incredible amount of money and therefore has a huge amount of influence in not just how we see the world, but how we can imagine other possibilities. And I love how Tochi Onyebuchi has talked about fiction as, quote, an opportunity to reframe the relationship between the individual and their environment. For instance, imagining what public safety could look like without a police state or without incarceration. So what are some of the ways you have explored or you may have wanted to explore how religion, spirituality could be different from how we currently experience and are taught to understand them? I will leave this open to whoever wants to jump in.
I will say that I have occasionally written stories just to try and force myself to try and think of something that I find difficult. Doesn't always work. I think my most controversial short story is the one called The Ones Who Stay and Fight, which is in conversation with Ursula K. Le Guin's...
That story haunted me for weeks.
Wow. Whoa. Okay. Yes. I mean, it is very much my most controversial work in that, like, there are people who absolutely hate this book, this story. A few weeks ago, I ran into somebody who had written this huge screed, just like ranting about it. This is an old story, but this person had just read it and they were hot and mad. But what I was trying to explore through it was, I was basically kind of an anti-racist take on the concept. And, you know, if you have not read The Ones Who Walk Away from Umlas, go read it. It is available in many places. It is a classic of science fiction and a classic exploration of human despair, I would say, and human difficulty stepping outside of the tried and true. So in it, basically, Le Guin posits that there is a utopian society. I'm not going to spoil any of it, but... She describes the society in great detail and then is speaking directly to the reader and the reader's skepticism and the fact that the reader cannot step away from the idea that this can't possibly be true. You can't have a society this good. People aren't like this. People aren't good. People aren't happy. And that the reader is expecting and even maybe needing something terrible to exist in this story just so they can believe in the good. And she's poking at that. Our inability to step outside of our own horror story that we are all personally living these days, our inability to step outside of that and perceive a different way of life as viable and good and a thing that can be done. And so, you know, you're talking about the without a police state. I was trying to envision what a society without a police state would look like, and I couldn't. And I decided to go ahead and write that down. You know, it was the fact that I kept coming back to somebody in the society has to do something policey. And that's not a word, but And I fought with this story and fought with it and finally decided to just kind of do it and share it and put it out there and let everybody see this is a thing I struggled with and could not shed myself, could not rid myself of. And I wanted people to think about what that means, you know, themselves. I wanted people to start trying to think of it themselves and nitpick what I did. So, you know, it sounds like lots of people did so. But it's important that you start to realize your own limitations and your own hang-ups when you are trying to process other people's ways of life. Even when you're making up a religion from whole cloth, how you come up with that religion is dictated by how you gained knowledge and understanding of your own faith in a lot of cases. So it's important to just kind of recognize the frameworks that we are working within and the lenses that we are seeing through. And you know, even if you can't get that lens out of the way, you got to know that it's there. So even when you're writing about religions that don't exist, you are still teaching your audience how to see. And maybe they will see farther than you, hopefully.
I think as well, on top of what they see, there's also what they want. I think there is an intersection of religion and spirituality, and also of the idea of a authoritarian police state, where it's about control. It is about the seeking, the search for control, both over ourselves and over others. And the place where it works is where it is looking for control over ourselves. Where it begins to fail is for control over others. And it comes down to want as well, which is, if we want a world without a police state, we come to a world where there is less to want because our needs have been met. And spirituality, in my head, it's very much another kind of food, another kind of hunger that we're filling within ourselves. We are lonely without our spirits. We are lonely without our dead. There is a hunger in there that we are trying to feed. And at the same time, how do we love them? How do we love ourselves? And it comes down to what we're allowed and what we want and what we're looking for.
Can you repeat the question again? Because I'm like, I'm like so into the responses here, but then I'm like, I lost track of what the question was.
No, that's totally fine. I'm just like, I was actually, if what are some of the ways that you have wanted or have explored in your work how we can think about religion differently than the ways in which we are currently taught? Like, whether it's what does religion look like, what does it serve, what are some of the things that you have wanted to interrogate and imagine differently?
Yeah, I think the reason why I forgot the question was because I didn't want to answer the question. Because, like, I had, like, an instant, like, a response of, I don't want to talk about that. Because there are things that I do with religion. And first thing I was thinking about was Who Fears Death in the Book of Phoenix, where I'm doing some things with religion. See, it's starting to stop now. I'm commenting on some aspects about religion that I find problematic. And the only way I can comment on those things is within story. Like speaking about those things is very hard for me. Like just nakedly speaking about those issues that I have with religion. And I mean, just to give you a little bit, I mean, I have some issues with Christianity. I will just say that. I've got beef with Christianity. I was raised Catholic, but I'm also black. So yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Won't I go think too there's deep. A bunch of diasporas that have that same feeling.
Like yeah.
Several million people, possibly billion world over, that have the same feeling.
Yeah, but it's hard to talk about because people get very emotional about those things. Those things, you know, and I'm those things that I, so.
Yeah, I'm Filipino. I have no idea what those issues might be with Catholicism. No idea.
They're just difficult. They're difficult things to talk about, like the role that Christianity played in slavery, the role that Christianity played in colonialism. Yeah, there's more, and so for me as a writer, I have a hard, like as you can see, I have a hard time like nakedly talking about those things. So it's easier for me to write them in a story. Mm-hmm. And so like Who Fears Death and the Book of Phoenix, the role that religious texts play in both of those stories and how things play out, and the idea of, and this is a theme that I keep coming back to, the power of story and the power of storytelling and what that does for humanity. Those are things that I'm just constantly interrogating, because this idea of storytelling and religion, they are not separate. And the way that they are used, there are just similarities. So I guess my point is that, yeah, I do that, but it's hard for me to talk about, and that's why I write novels.
Which is a perfectly fair answer, and one I think is really good to actually think about why storytelling matters. It's a way for us to interrogate and communicate things that we have no language or capability of saying straight out, right? Matthew, what about you? How does all of this work for you?
Well, something to go to that question of like a world without religion, kind of. Mm-hmm. I sort of went there a bit in Star Splitter. I mean, I worked a lot of that out for myself that doesn't make it into the book, because the book is a first-person narrative, so that character, there's just a lot of stuff she doesn't think about or know about. But the book is basically taking the classic teleporter paradox or teleporter problem, like a science fiction trope, the idea being that you're not actually sending the matter that is you. Like, they're scanning you and then sending the data and then reconstituting you on the other side. So when you get into the teleporter, and this came from a short story by James Patrick Kelly called Think Like a Dinosaur that I read in college that stayed with me for the next 20 years or whatever, and Star Splitter came out of it. Like, what is that like to get into that scanning chamber knowing that this body is going to be destroyed and I will... or a version of me will wake up on the other side? And I realized a society that's going to embrace that has to let go of the notion of the soul. Ooh. And so that sent me down kind of a whole rabbit hole. And I was kind of, I invented a sort of new terminology for what that would result in, and then there's actually a political movement that's referenced but never really explicitly shown that is reactionary against that. So yeah, it's kind of, I think about spirituality a lot. I mean, I was raised in a religion that I'm no longer a part of, and so I get the like spiritual but not religious kind of distinction.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually had me wondering. I can't think of a single story where one of the questions has been, what would religion look like without hierarchy?
I can.
Ooh. Please, recommendations.
Parable Books and Earthseed.
Oh, yeah.
They kept trying to make Lauren Olamina like she's obviously the origin of it, but they kept trying to make her like the priestess, and she kept fighting that because that was not what it was supposed to be. Every person who believed in Earthseed was also a priest or priestess, if you wanted to think of it that way, or was an expert on how they became God and how they forged their relationship with God. So I think that counted as a flat religion.
Which means I need to actually go and update my to-read pile, which is going to bury me at this point.
I do wish that she had done the third book. I really, there's so, if you didn't know.
Hang on it though,
right? No, she'd stopped. But for those of you that don't know, there was supposed to be a third book in that Parable trilogy. There's a beautiful article on LitReads, maybe, about how they found her notes after she died of, you know, the different iterations of it. She wrote several versions of it and was never happy with it. And how, you know, she kept trying to explore it and could never really quite get there. And it sounded like the core of it was going to be that the people who followed Earthseed many years after the first two books go to another planet and actually start the process of becoming Earthseed on another planet, bringing humanity to the stars. But the planet that they landed on was supposed to be very gray and dreary and kind of depressing. And that began to change the religion. That began to change Earthseed, because it's really hard to feel like you just have to kind of, you know, how you respond to change is your expression of God, but you are depressed and you, how you respond to change begins to be you aren't responding. So I'm explaining it badly, but I really wanted to know where she was going to go with that.
So I think, you know, as we are winding down, we've got 13 minutes left. I think all of you at some point or another have talked about why it's important for us as readers, writers, editors, anyone who consumes these sort of stories, to not just think of them, there's no such thing as just entertainment, because we are not consuming this in a vacuum. I would like to know what you think in particular about religion and spirituality and systems of faith, that you think, why, what are the things that we should be thinking about, and why is it important for us in this particular moment that we're in to interrogate how the stories we are reading shape our perceptions of the world as it is and the world as we could imagine it to be.
I will say, the first thing that pops into my head, I have been doing a lot of thinking lately about the ways that we as a culture separate religion from life and also separate spirituality from science, technology, etc. You know, one of my first real encounters with spirituality but not religion was Carl Sagan, and Carl Sagan pointing out that we are all, you know, the products, the building blocks of life come from the hearts of fallen stars. I mean, you know, we are all star, made of star stuff, and that's religious. That is a spiritual belief that impacts how we as a society could think of ourselves. And it didn't get shared. It isn't being shared, and in some cases, it's considered blasphemous. In some faiths, to say that we are the same stuff as a star, and so on. And I just wonder why we resist and separate and compartmentalize religion in the ways that we do. I have no conclusion for that statement. It's just a thing that I constantly think about.
I mean, I think that if there's one thing, if we need one specific thing that I feel people should look for in religion, spirituality, it just popped into my head. Fine, I'm just gonna say this, but like, how does it treat women? That's just like that. That's usually my test, you know. And I am very. That's my test. If I see that women are treated as down here, you know. Once I see that, I basically dismiss the whole thing. It's very often that I see it. I just, you know, so that's my test. If you don't pass that test, you're not passing anything for me. So there's that. But I guess the advice that I would give is just to be open to just listening to all the different ways of thinking, even with the flaws. Even if I'm going to kind of contradict myself a little bit here, but even if it's got some issues with women, listen and kind of take it in. And because I just feel like the truth is in many voices. It's in the voice of many. So you have to be able to listen to all different types of thought, different types of spirituality, different types of religion. But like, when I say listen, it doesn't mean that you follow it. You have to follow it. I mean, that's something that I personally am very resistant to, this idea of following something. I like to observe. I like to take things in and then think about it and let it and be open to letting it affect me. I don't have this need to let something consume me. And I think that like right now I'm seeing a lot of that where people need to be consumed by something. They need something that's going to tell them what to do and where they can just sit back and follow that thing. They like to follow things. And I just that openness of just taking things in, taking different ways of thinking it, being comfortable around those who think differently. You know, all of that I think is really, really important right now.
I think we come to religion first in a lot of ways. For a lot of us, you know, it's a smack to the face, it's an extra bit of food, it's a charity box full of warm clothes for the winter that you never expected. But what comes after that usually is the story. Religion, spirituality is giving you a story to hang on to. And, you know, my degree is, I actually have 2 degrees. None of them are in creative writing, but one of them is in media studies. The other one is in political science. And what those degrees teach you very quickly is everyone is telling you a story. And sometimes the story is as simple as, hey, the stove's hot, baby, don't touch it. And sometimes the story is, you know who's responsible for all the shit that's going on in your life? It's that guy over there. Yeah, we've all heard those, haven't we? And you need to be careful who is telling you this story and why are they telling you this story. And it doesn't matter if it's a fairy tale. It doesn't matter if you hear it at church. It doesn't matter if you hear it at temple. They're telling you a story and you need to figure out why. And you need to figure out what they're trying to get out of you. Do they want to make you feel like shit? Do they want you to understand that other people are shit? Are they just telling you that, hey, maybe everyone needs to be fed? That's probably the story you want to listen to. You want to follow that person. But at the end of the day, I don't believe we're stories, we're people. And that means that we get to judge stories, and we have to judge stories, and we have to judge our gods, and we have to judge our dead.
That sounds like a really
good
thing to end
with. Yeah, that was quite profound. I would totally echo that. Like, if you're thinking about science and religion, which are often put in, you know, as opposed, in opposition to one another, like, they're both stories that describe our experience in ways that are made tolerable and or coherent. But the problem is they admit different sources of data and evidence. Like science and religion, those two experiences, and they rely on very different sources of data. Sometimes, again, going back to that, sometimes no data, sometimes it's treated as self-evident. But yeah, I totally love what you said about that, because I think anytime you are hearing a story, it's important to ask who and what is this story serving? Like, what does this story maintain? And should that be maintained? And particularly with religion, it has historically propped up systems that have caused incalculable damage. And so I do think that interrogation of those stories is really important to hopefully find, if it can be found, something spiritually meaningful that you can smash and grab and leave all this shit behind.
And don't trust us either. We're up here, but, you know, maybe ask us why we're doing what we're doing.
See, now you're just going to get a whole bunch of questions from folks as you're going to be at your signing tables. Okay, so we are down to our final minutes, and I would love to make sure you all have a chance to just sort of talk about what is a project or a piece of work that you have going on right now that you want to make sure that people know about. We're going to start with Matthew over here.
Well, I'm currently working on a fantasy that I've been working on since I was basically in high school, but it's actually under contract now, so I have to finish it. But Star Splitter is my most recent novel, other than I've done some lore books for Diablo and things like that. Those are just sort of side projects that are just for fun because I'm a geek.
Okay, so I'm at the tail end of this tour, and I just got the permission to talk about this. I'm currently writing a historical Americana Magica novel about the 1890s, the Gilded Age, you know, that incredibly foreign time when the rich were hyper-rich and the rest of us were just trying to make a living. You know, never seen anything like that before. And it's about a Vietnamese-American woman named Judith who's on the run from France. She shows up in the United States. She's not having a very good time because, God forbid, she has to work for a living now. And she understands that if she sews a white girl's face to her own, she might get the chance to dance at the balls and marry a demon lord. Sounds cool, right?
Wait, did you just say sew a white girl's face to her own?
I thought I was relatively clear, yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a thing that happens. You can do that.
So
I'll let that go.
So I've been calling 2025 the great conjunction for me because I've got a lot of things coming out this year or that have come out. In the first Death of the Author, my novel, came out in January, and that is, I guess, a Nigerian-American family saga and a post-human robot fable. So those two things. And so, yeah, that came out in January. Then in, and then I have the, later this month, April 20, like later this month, the second book in my She Who Knows novella trilogy is coming out. It's called One Way Witch. And then, I can't remember all of them. Okay. And then it's a good problem. It's a good problem. I keep telling myself. And then in August, I have my graphic novel called The Space Cat coming out, which is about my cat. And then I think in September, I am the editor of the Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy Anthology, and that's coming out in September. Yeah. So four things, four books. Coming out in 1 year, yeah, it's a lot. The great conjunction, that's why I call it that.
Yeah, you're not going to be busy at all.
No, not at all. Nothing to do.
Yeah. I am not actually working on very much at this moment. After doing 11 books in 10 years, I decided I was going to take a few years of a break.
Good.
I can't really stop myself from writing, so of course I'm still poking at things, but I'm allowing myself to write as, you know, the mood takes me, as opposed to like, oh, every day I've got to do XYZ words. And it's been interesting to kind of loosen myself up like that. But I think the only thing that I'm really working on right now that is potentially viable is a short story. And if I can just get the core of it quite right. There's a short story that I'm working on right now about a woman who works at Waffle House. And she and her companions, she and the members of her night shift, periodically get snatched off to another dimension where they have to fight aliens. And in between, they come back and they're just living their lives. They're, you know, trying to make ends meet. They're doing mutual aid. They're doing all kinds of stuff to take care of each other. And it's really just about what it's like to live with constant intrusions of just absolute batshittery in your life. I wonder where that's coming from. So if I can get it done, I think that will be my next short story. We'll see if I can manage to finish it off.
Are we sure this is fiction? Because it sounds like the kind of thing that would happen.
I did interview an actual Waffle House employee in order to understand more about what it was like, and what she told me made it sound like that was a pretty typical thing that happens. So, yeah.
And on that note, I would like to thank everybody for joining us this evening. And I'd love to thank our speakers for an absolutely fantastic discussion. Thank you so much. And there will be directions for what to do afterward.
One more round of applause for our wonderful authors. Thank you so much, Michi, for moderating.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.